Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Tom Soldner, and he's continuing his series entitled Heirs According to Promise, Parents and Passions, Mapping Human Emotional Systems. Today's individual title is Imaginative Gridlock, Being Emotionally Stuck. The session number is SOT-2002, and let's listen in.
I'm Tom Soldner, and we're talking about family emotional process. Talk about gridlock today. How people get stuck, emotionally stuck in systems, both family systems and organizations and ultimately in our society too, how societies can become stuck. Let me say, as I did yesterday, if you weren't here, at some books that are in the library. One is called Family Ties That Bind. This one I'd recommend because it's a very basic book about family systems, and it deals with families first. So I think it's probably the most helpful one. Another one that the bookstore does not have and did not order it, I think, because it's $25 to $30 book. But it's by Roberta M. Gilbert. Extraordinary Relationships, A New Way of Thinking About Human Interactions. And it also is about family emotional process and family systems. The bookstore does have three other books, all about family systems, but it talks about family systems in the context of congregations. Creating a Healthier Church by Ron Richardson, and two by Peter Steinke, How Your Church Family Works and Healthy Congregations. So you might want to take a look at those. All of those will give you a good idea of what family systems is about. But as I said, these deal more personally and with families. And so I recommend them highly. Someone else mentioned a book yesterday that I probably could have mentioned that some of you may have seen, by a woman by the name of Elizabeth Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R. And they're pretty popular. Dance of Anger, A Dance of Intimacy, and I think A Dance of Deception. It uses family emotional process, essentially. And I believe she was a student of Murray Bowen as well. Somebody asked me a question that I want to just hold up and then say we'll deal with it later. And if this is your question, we'll deal with it and you can ask it later on. And if it's not your question, we won't deal with it, or we can talk about it another time. And that is, someone said, what about the effect of spirituality on family systems? We talked about the emotional system, the instinctual in human systems and human behavior, the feeling systems, which are the manifestations of those underlying emotions, how we feel about things. You know, the same emotion underneath may manifest itself in either fear or anger or sadness, but it may be the same emotion, the same instinctual reaction that brings those different kinds of feelings out. And then there's the intellectual level, in which we can think about those things we're feeling. We can think about and try to think about what those emotions, what those reactions are in our lives, and how we respond to other people as a result of that. But what about the spiritual? Does the spiritual affect any of that? Now, if that's your question, raise it a little bit later and we'll talk about that. The other thing I think is really important about family emotional process is that, well, let me say it this way. It has not been terribly popular among the psychoanalytic community, among therapists generally. And I think part of the reason is that there is There's an enormous business and economy out there that's based on therapy and psychoanalysis. And And family systems essentially says, you can pretty well do this yourself. As you think about your family as a system, as you think about the organizations that you're in, and you know the principles, that you can say, oh, I see what's happening here, and begin to respond in a different way. To be clear about who you are, which is the most important thing, and then be able to take stands as an individual and persevere in those stands despite sabotage that will come. We talked yesterday about self-differentiation, the ability to be ourselves in many different situations. Ed Friedman said, no act of self-differentiation will go unpunished. People will always try to sabotage that, to pull you back to the way things were before. And the secret to changing a system is not only to take stands, to be self-differentiated, but then also to persevere in that stand through sabotage, despite the sabotage that you'll experience. Let me do a little review for those of you who weren't here yesterday, and maybe for those of you who were. It was pretty theoretical, I understand that, and may not have clicked for all of you all the time. Family systems theory is about, number one, that emotional process is rooted in life processes. It's practically, some would say it is a deeper human phenomenon than our genetic makeup, that it's rooted in, it's the nature of protoplasm. It's how cells work and divide and differentiate themselves in our bodies. So it's what we have in common, not only with other human beings, but with animals and with the organic world as we know it. So it's not just about human beings, not just about people. It's more deeply rooted than that in the processes of life. Secondly, it emphasizes the function of an individual's behavior in a broader context of relationships. It's not just internal, it's not what's going on inside a person, which is primarily the focus of psychoanalysis and most of the fields that use the social science construct of reality. There may be influences coming on me from the outside, but they're interested in what's happening, what are those influences within me. Family system says there is a field that is formed when two people come into a relationship. And if more, there's a larger field that is formed. And it's what happens, it's the energy and the what happens in the relationships between people that is important. And so we don't look so much to saying, for instance, this is one consequence of it, rather than identifying a patient in a family or a sick aspect of a particular organization, we say, what's going on in this organization or what's going on in this family that manifests itself in this one person who is not functioning in healthy ways? So it's what's happening in the system, not so much what's happening in the person. Thirdly, people are born into and occupy functioning positions in families. These things are modeled over generations, and they're anchored in emotions, feeling, in subjective processes. Families, there are certain expectations over time, and maybe different in different families, of firstborn children. There are certain expectations in families, and sometimes very specific expectations as to how women will function in a family or in a relationship, and so forth. And it's not just the product of the parents, but it's the parents who learned that functioning and inherited from their parents, and so on. So it's a multi-generational process. And finally, we focus on the field, the space between people. I mentioned that earlier. And emotional functioning is reciprocal. It's not just one person who functions and another person who receives, but both people are actors in the process, and both reinforce the other. I'll give you a couple examples. It is not just that parents affect how their children will behave and function in the family, but children learn very quickly how to behave to get their parents to function in certain ways as well. And it reinforces it. The child doesn't pick up his or her room when they're supposed to, and the father can't stand it, and goes in and says over and over again, and the child doesn't, because the child knows father will come in and do it eventually. He can wait him out. And it sort of reinforces the father's over-functioning in that area, whereas the child can continue, and the father's over-functioning reinforces the child's under-functioning in the situation. And so you get a circular kind of thing. You have an older child and a younger child. The older child will act in certain ways so that the younger child functions in a certain way or relates in a certain way. But the younger child learns about that very quickly to reinforce the ways an older child acts that suits the younger child. And so they reinforce one another. Sometimes you get that in terms of sick and healthy persons in a system. Sick people learn, they get identified as the sick one in the family. But the sick one in the family notices when they are sick, the family's attentions are focused on them. And the family functions in such a way in that focus as to have a certain stability and a certain peace. And when that, let's say, child, or it could be one of the spouses, becomes well, they suddenly notice, the child notice that the parents don't get along so well. They don't function so well when they have to deal with one another. Instead, they can focus and deal with the child, and it balances out the system. And the child is encouraged in that way, not directly, but is encouraged to function as the sick person, as the patient in the family. And that child later on may pass on that kind of functioning to his or her children as well. You get it in terms of distancers and people who want togetherness. You know, some member of the family wants this family to be together. We want to be together around the table. You know, we want to eat our meals together all the time. Well, I don't know whether it's the children or whether it's the husband, you know, who sort of pulls away from that, always finds an excuse to be someplace else, not to be together at the table. The more one tries to pull people together, the more the other flees that situation and seeks separateness. The interesting thing about that is that sometimes when the one who is fleeing says, well, I don't like this always being pulled together, I don't like that, may turn around and become the pursuer in the relationship. Oftentimes, then the pursuer, the one who wants togetherness, will move in the other direction. It's a matter of functioning. It's not a matter of who those individuals are, but it's a matter of how they've learned to function in the system. Are there any questions?
Well, in that example, is it a matter of they're only able to get so close? Is that part of it?
It's what they've learned. It's what they've learned. It's what they've inherited from their parents and how they learn to function.
This functioning is subconscious or unconscious or whatever. People don't, you're not really aware of it. And then you said when someone turns around, when the person that's being chased or that's running away, when they turn around and confront or communicate what's going on, then things change. So if you bring that function out into your consciousness, it seems like things have a tendency to change.
And the important thing, the functioning is at a an emotional level more often, not so much a conscious level. It's at an emotional level. It's a reactive sort of thing. And when one is able to think about it and recognize what is happening, then one can change. Now, what happens oftentimes in that situation, let me give you an example. I said, if you want to change a system, you must take a stand and then persevere in it. That a person who has been fleeing a relationship says, well, this must be what's happening here, so I'm not going to flee anymore. I'm going to pursue. I'm going to embrace this togetherness. And they start doing that. There may be a while, and it may be a fair amount of time, where the one who has wanted this togetherness, the first one, the pursuer, just loves it. Just loves it. The person who's going to do this, if it's going to have any effect on the system, has got to persevere in it. And more often than not, the one who does that turns around and says, you know, I don't know if I can take this much longer. I'm doing okay now, but I don't know how much longer I can take this. But they need to persevere in it if they want to see a change in the system. The other thing we talked about is that there are eight key concepts in family emotional systems. And I'll just go through them very quickly. Emotional system, that's what we're talking about here. The second is differentiation, and it's the ability of persons to be a self, to know what their boundaries are, to know where they end and other people begin, to be able to take stands and know why they're taking those stands, to be goal-oriented toward the future, and to move in a self-directed way. The third is multi-generational transmission process. It continues through generation to generation. It's passed on. Emotional triangles, that the primary structure in human relationships is a triangle. That a two-person relationship is essentially unstable and almost always moves to a triangle. That is, either two people and an idea, two people and an anxiety or fear, two people or three people. And in a family, there may be overlapping triangles. So you can have a... and the primary rule, we're going to talk more about emotional triangles tomorrow. You know, you may have a mother and a father and a daughter. And the father and the daughter don't get along at all. Well, what does the mother want? Mother wants to fix this, right? Want to fix that relationship. You cannot fix the relationship between the other two people in a triangle. What you can is have a well-differentiated relationship with the father, a well-differentiated relationship with the daughter. And that's the most effective way of dealing with an uneasy or stressful relationship between two other people. You cannot cause change in a relationship that's on the opposite side of the triangle. That's the hardest thing for us to learn, because we'd like other people to be different. and ones we're not going to be able to talk about so much just because of time. Family projection process, sibling position, that there are certain characteristics of sibling positions, of people, first children, second children, third children, whether you're the younger brother of an older sister, and those sorts of things. There's very clear characteristics and functioning for people in sibling positions. Emotional cutoff, that oftentimes, that a cutoff does not stop the stress of emotional relationships between people in a system. I said something about that yesterday in terms of there was a little uneasiness sometimes in me about my relationship with my parents because I wanted them to affirm me, you know, as a person in my own right, as a professional. I mean, this is after I was a grown man and working and everything. And there was always the feeling that I was still their little boy. Well, I was. and I still am. Even though they're both dead, I still am. I went to South Africa. Now, that's far enough away, right, to establish yourself. But when the telephone rang and I answered and my mother said, "Hello, Tom," it was all right back, the way it always was. There's no getting away from that, and there's no cutting off from the anxiety in relationships that we have with people in our emotional system, in our families. And the eighth one, societal emotional process, which simply says that all of these ways of thinking about relationships and systems don't just work in terms of families or friendship groups, but they also work on the level of societies, in larger organizations and societies. I put down here a ninth one with a question mark because I've been told, don't know directly, but that Murray Bowen was working on another concept, that of spirituality, and what difference it made. What was its function in this whole way of thinking about things? He was working on it at the time of his death. And to my knowledge, no one has ever picked that up and continued to work on it. I have some ideas about that I'll be happy to share with you, maybe toward the end if we have a little time for questions about that. Anything else about these?
If I could say something here, I've been a psychiatrist for 30 years, so I've worked with a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that multi-generational transmission process, when I worked in Christian community, mostly with Christians, and if they don't feel attacked and they understand that there's good intention, they can sometimes learn new behaviors. They sometimes can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if they're in a role where they're feeling guilty and defensive, then that backs out.
And if that were not the case, you know, there'd be no point in our talking about, you know, this here as well. So one, you know, what one is hoping for is better functioning, you know, for us to function better than we have. There's a concept in family systems, this concept of self-differentiation, and that people are born with a level of differentiation very similar to that of their parents. And it's called basic, the basic self. And that pretty well does not change through life. It's who they are, it's what they were born with. That over time, they develop a functional self and are able to function at a higher level of differentiation as individuals. The family systems also says during times of stress and anxiety, that people most often revert to that basic self, that basic level. I think I'm doing real well, you know, in being well differentiated over against my family, and I think I'm doing real well, you know, when my parents were alive, with my relating to my parents. And then something happens, I don't know, my dad gets sick and my mother calls, you know, very worried and wanting me to come over. And suddenly, you know, my calm, my ability to deal in a self-differentiated way, sort of my functional self disappears. It's permeable. And I sort of move back to that basic self. So the, you know, the goal of family systems were that, you know, would be that we develop a larger functional self for ourselves, and that we learn to operate out of that as much as possible.
And about the emotional kernel, this seems sort of the opposite of what you described. You described being emotionally connected when you talked about as an adult relating to your parents.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Emotion, some people will try to, I didn't, as a matter of fact, it may not have been a good example because I didn't go overseas in order to get away from my parents. But there are folks, you know, who say maybe in late adolescence, their college years, maybe a little bit later, and are still living at home, I've got to get out of here. I don't want to be part of this anymore. You can't get along. And they cut off. They go away, and they don't talk anymore with their parents. They don't communicate. Or brothers and sisters who, because of something that's happened in the family, simply cut off and don't communicate anymore. Now, what I'm saying is those people may, in whatever context they are and with their own family at home, may be able to function fairly well, in fairly healthy ways. At times of stress, they will revert, and when there is connection, when there are things that happen that connect them again, they find they don't have themselves anymore, any better in control. If they go home, they decide, well, it's been enough time. It's been 15 years, and I haven't seen my family. I'll go home for Thanksgiving. And they get home for Thanksgiving, and 5 minutes later, they know it was a mistake, or they think it was a mistake, because all the old stuff just comes flooding back again. You can't cut off, is what it's saying.
It's impossible.
Yeah, you can try, and lots of people try. They do cut off, but there are still the connections, and there's still the
the learned behaviors persist. Because they're subconscious.
Yeah, and their way of functioning. Yeah. Their way of functioning in a system.
Tom, if I understand you right, if I related it to my own life, I have to get things in my own life. I'm a teacher, I deal with kids. And I found when my kids were growing up that it was much easier to deal as the professional out here than as the parent in here. Because it would, and I'm trying to reply, because of the system that was set up in here, whereas I had a role out here. I was the professional, and I was dealing with kids. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's you're talking about the same dynamics. Okay. Yeah.
Is this somewhat like the old tapes that are in us all the time, and we just don't get rid of them?
Yeah, I. It has. It's a matter of functioning. But again, I want to suggest that it's not just about it's not just about what's inside us, because you may be able to function in a system other than your family. You've still got all those tapes, what we call tapes, and you may be able to function fine in a different system. But when you come in the field of the family or a particular system, the functioning has to do with the relationships and with the space between people, with that system. And so, you know, in some situations, those tapes don't, you know, are not problematic for you. Does that make sense?
It isn't clear to me, but then that doesn't mean it isn't clear to us.
I think of the way magnets are, you know. You turn them one way and they come together, but you turn them another way and they push each other apart. Mm-hmm. That seems to be helpful for me when I think of field. The kind of pressure and binds, the ties that bind, or don't.
And doesn't it say the same thing? It says that it is the same emotional field and forces that draw those magnets together or that push them apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just turned a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Same force.
So we talk about a family being fused, unable to separate,
mm-hmm.
and we talk about family or members of the family being cut off.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It's the intensity of the emotional relationship. And oftentimes that has to do with anxiety. Let me mention one other concept that's important. I mentioned it yesterday just briefly. In family systems theory, individuality and togetherness are considered biologically rooted life forces. Individuality inclines an organism to follow its own directions and be independent and a particular entity. The togetherness force propels individuals to not be different than others, to be directed by others, to be dependent. And it's a kind of instinctual kind of thing. The move toward togetherness is basic and instinctual, and there is, it's a given. It's a given. It's also necessary. It's also necessary. The move toward individuality is to distinctiveness and to differentiation in human systems takes work. And being together in healthy ways depends on people being able to be individuals in a system. So two forces, togetherness and individuality. We talk a lot about the importance of community, for instance. We talk about here at Holin, no question about it. Community is basic to human life as well. It's an important thing. But healthy communities are made up of individuals who know who they are and are not simply one mass of emotions and so fused together. So if we want healthy communities, what we need to work on is our own self-differentiation as members of those communities. To be who we are, to know who we are, to be willing to take stands in those communities, and to persevere in them, despite the fact that oftentimes others will try to undermine those stands. But for the sake of the community, the health of the community, and the survival of the community, we need to take those stands and persevere in them. So survivability of individuals ensures the survivability of a community. I don't want to say ensures. I want to say promotes and encourages the survivability of the community. Let me say a little bit about anxiety, and then I want you to see a short tape, videotape. One of the major variables I've mentioned that affect whether behavior is guided emotionally or intellectually by the reptilian or brain or the limbic system or the prefrontal cortex or the upper part of our brain is stress, the intensity of anxiety. Anxiety is the arousal of an organism to a real or an imagined threat. Anxiety leaves a person oftentimes feeling vulnerable and powerless. And so we seek to avoid anxiety at all costs. We react to things to try to get out of this feeling of anxiety. Sometimes it results in depression, paranoia, things that we would sometimes call sick or unwell, unhealthy behavior. It is simply a way of coping with and responding to stress. Sometimes what we call sickness is a more effective way of dealing with stress and anxiety, though it's not, you know, socially acceptable for most in most societies. Some people who are paranoid, who we identify as ill, actually are dealing with pain or anxiety that are part of their systems, and they're dealing with it in a way that's effective for them. But it's not ways that we'd like to see or that we generally accept in society, or maybe within the system that they're a part of. In family systems, illness has to do, we would identify illness in three ways. And when we say this, you'll recognize all sorts of people that you don't consider sick or dysfunctional even, but it depends on degrees. Number one, a person who interferes in the relationship of other people. Now, there's little interferences and there are great interferences. People who are unceasingly trying to convert others to one's own point of view. Willingly trying to coerce them, maybe emotionally, maybe even physically, into changing their minds. And thirdly, an inability to relate to people who do not agree with them. Our society is a victim of chronic anxiety, I would say. That is, it's not so much that everybody is anxious and therefore society is anxious, but there is a kind of anxiety that's the air we breathe in our society. It's sort of like being in a gas fume filled room, and everybody can function for a while until someone lights a match. And then we say, it's his fault. But the fact is that that person becomes the focus of all of this anxiety and what's happened as a result when everybody has been a part of it. It's been a part of the system. It's been a part of the environment in which we've lived. So everybody is a victim of it. I want to play a tape on leadership. Murray Bowen is talking about chronic anxiety in societies. I'd like to say you can listen to this in terms of our society. Listen to it in terms of your family as well. The characteristics of chronically anxious societies. And then he wants to talk, and then he talks about three fallacies of common wisdom. And we'll have some questions and comments after that. Someone wants to turn the blinds down. I think it'll be easier to see it.
Frequently fail, creating an atmosphere of self-perpetuating anxiety. Dr. Greven thinks that leaders cannot function in such an environment. People overreact, point fingers, and lay blame. Innovative approaches to long-standing problems are often met with scorn and sabotage, rather than a willingness to try something new. In Dr. Greven's view, things are getting worse rather than better.
I think that American society for the last 25 or 30 years has been functioning like an anxious family. And there are certain characteristics of an anxious family that you can see in American society. One is a high level of reactivity.
By reactivity, I mean responses that are automatic. Responses that bypass the cortex. Responses that come out of the limbic system. Responses that are driven by emotion. And what happens in a highly anxious system that has reached the point of regression is that it becomes almost impossible to know where one person ends and another person begins. And everybody loses their capacity to be separate. When that happens, we then get a regression of imagination. Because to be imaginative, you have to be able to have some separateness. What will happen in this kind of system then is it will tend to stay stuck, focused on its symptoms.
The second is the herding instinct. In a herding instinct, people make togetherness more important than differentiation or individuality, and a system that's oriented toward herding will adapt to the troublemaker, organize itself around the troublemaker, and then reject the efforts of the well-differentiated people to take stands. The third one is that the anxious system, whether it is family or society, is a blaming society. It avoids challenge.
So what the highly anxious, reactive, hurting system is going to do is a lot of blaming. They'll blame within and they'll blame out. Within, they'll blame one another. So people are constantly saying, you instead of I. You're doing this to me, you don't understand this, your mother did this, et cetera, instead of, this is where I have to stand, this is what I believe, these are my responsibilities, and so on. But it will not only be within the system, it will be outside. So television will be blamed, the church will be blamed, physicians will be blamed, therapists will be blamed. And they will project their responsibility out into the institutions of society. And that is why litigiousness and violence are twin symptoms of societal aggression. What both violence and litigiousness are methods of projecting or displacing the immaturity and the irresponsibility and the anxiety that's in a family out into society. The fourth is a quick fix mentality. The quick fix mentality shows up in a variety of ways. First of all, it will show up in terms of linear thinking. Everybody wants simple answers to their problems. Well, what's the cause? Instead of thinking systemically and recognizing that there is rarely a linear cause and that most problems are the result of a variety of things in action.
The quick fix mentality, you know, just shows up everywhere. It shows up in not only illegal drugs, but also legal drugs. And it shows up in an effort to find a gene for everything, the gene for homosexuality, a gene for bedwetting, a gene for schizophrenia, and so on. That's not the way genes work. Genes, you don't have a gene program, you have a gene pool. And which genes express themselves has a lot to do with biochemistry, which in turn has a lot to do with family process and so on. And as I see it, there's this effort to come up with easy answers. A chronically anxious system, whether it's a family or civilization, wants certainty. And so instead of being willing, and this is related to my whole point about Columbus, instead of being really interested in adventure, they're more concerned with certainty. And the pursuit of information in an atmosphere of adventure is very different than the pursuit of information in an atmosphere that is anxious and wants certainty.
To be an effective leader, one must deal with these characteristics of chronic anxiety, whether one is leading an entire nation or a small congregation.
Whenever you find those four characteristics, you don't have well-differentiated leadership. They'll work against the promotion of well-differentiated leadership. But conversely, and this is the chicken or egg thing, it's only when you can promote well-differentiated leadership that chronic anxiety will go down.
To be able to find their way in a sea of anxiety, innovative leaders, much like Columbus, must overcome various barriers in their quest to become more effective. The first is the emphasis on information and technique, rather than an understanding of the emotional processes that are at work in a family or institution. The over-reliance on the opinions of outside experts is what Dr. Friedman calls the fallacy of expertise.
I believe that the social science establishment, psychology, sociology, anthropology, and so on, as accurate as its information is, has been co-opted by the anxiety of society. And that instead of the social sciences really being helpful to leaders, they have become our civilization's psychological defense. And that we focus on their data as a way of avoiding being in the truth.
When leaders rely on outside information rather than learn to follow their own instincts, they are in pursuit of the quick fix rather than dealing with the real problems. This may be the result of a desire to avoid conflict and seek comfort instead. Consequently, tensions develop between those who want things to stay the same and those who are willing to find better ways.
Recently, I've been saying that from the point of view of relationships, and the way the social sciences deal with relationships, the whole learned establishment deals with relationships, the world is flat. They're that far off base. And that, I guess the best example of it would be for me to say that the critical issue out there in life is dealing with the forces of self and the forces for togetherness, how they're constantly in conflict, how that issue transcends all the distinctions made by the social sciences, such as gender and data and so on. And my saying that the critical issue is not gender, it's not data, it's maturity. And by maturity, I mean the willingness to take responsibility for your own emotional being and destiny.
According to Dr. Friedman, people pursue data to justify their actions rather than trust their own intuitions.
The pursuit after data in our society is a form of substance abuse. And leaders imbibe data as a way of avoiding taking space. Leaders, and that is, the anxiety in society gets everybody focused on getting more and more information as a way of calming their anxiety. But we reach thresholds pretty quick, and so we got to go out and read more books and go to more conferences. All I'm saying is that everything you've heard before today is wrong. Drugs become addiction the same way alcohol, drugs, or anything else becomes an addiction. People are scared that they don't have the truth. They're overwhelmed with information. So they're in a bond. They're overwhelmed by the information, and they seek the information to get out of the bond. It's a terrible situation. So that the average person keeps thinking that if only I knew enough, I could solve anything. And that puts them, again, off the wagon, so to speak. It gets them pursuing data. So they go to conferences and read the latest books, and they keep trying to keep up, which makes them more anxious. So it's a vicious cycle.
In addition to the fallacy of expertise, there are two other barriers to effective leadership. One of these is that the most dependent members of any organization set the agenda. In this case, the energy and attention of the leader is oriented toward weakness rather than strength. This is what Dr. Friedman calls the fallacy of empathy.
I want to come at empathy from two different points of view. First, from the point of view of responsibility, and second, from the point of view of pathology. There is somehow the notion that empathy is better than sympathy. Sympathy is Latin for feeling with. Empathy is Greek for feeling in. There is somehow the assumption that if you could get inside of a person and feel their feelings, that's more helpful to them than being distant. I think that's absolutely wrong. I think the critical issue in helping people is being able to set limits to their invasiveness, and it has nothing to do with whether you can feel for them. I see no evidence for the fact that feeling for people helps them grow. I think what helps people grow is not overgrowing them and not letting them overgrow you.
Dr. Friedman's point of view on empathy is important to understand. He is not suggesting that leaders should be uncaring about members of their group, but rather that they can better serve when they stand on their own and are not overly influenced by any complaints some members of the group might have. According to Dr. Friedman, the thought that recalcitrant members of a group can be regulated through reasonableness, role modeling, or consensus seeking, rather than by setting limits on those who lack self-regulation, is misguided.
I'm all in favor of people feeling for other people. I don't think you can make people feel for other people. And when it comes to leadership, I think defining self is more critical than feeling for others. Why? Because all the noxious, dangerous, toxic forces in life lack self-regulation. And unless you can define yourself to the forces in life that lack self-regulation, then you're going to be done in by them.
Empathy, when applied inappropriately, can actually increase problems in an organization, causing trouble to spread like a malignant cancer. Cancer cells, like troublemakers in organizations, are, by their very nature, incredibly selfish, having no responsibility to other cells. Lacking in self-regulation, they divide uncontrollably, killing nearby healthy cells in the process.
And that's true about viruses and malignant cells and totalitarian nations and troublemaking members of families and institutions. They are invasive of other space, not because they necessarily willfully want to take them over, but because they lack self-regulation, and they therefore ooze in and invade. Secondly, organisms that lack self-regulation cannot learn from their experience. And the great folly in our society is trying to put insight into unmotivated people. It affects therapy, it affects education, it affects business, it affects everyone. We are constantly trying to put motivation into unmotivated people, into people that lack self-regulation. And they can't learn from their experience. But having said that, up to this point, what I have to add is, even though everything I said to this point might be true, pathogens cannot create pathology on their own. There must be the complicity of the host. There must also be a lack of self-regulation in the host. The focus on empathy undercuts the qualities that are necessary for leadership. And the assumption is, as long as we're good, and as long as we're nice, and as long as we feel for others, eventually we can get through. That's not my experience.
Dr. Friedman's contention is that while values are important on a personal level, they cannot be transferred to other individuals who are not receptive to the same values.
I think values are extremely important for guiding principles of how to lead your own life. But the assumption that you can make other people better by putting values into them, that's the big mistake. People are going to grow up, people are going to mature when they're put in situations where they have to. And that occurs when the more mature people stop adapting to them. Well, to do that, the more mature people have to work through their values. The great line I have is from Seneca, the Roman thinker, that a sailor without a destination has trouble discerning the good wind from the ill wind. If you don't know anything, how do you know what to do with this storm? Do you lay it out, do you puff it out, like going foolish, you outflank it and lose time? You have to have values, vision, a sense of goals, a sense of purpose to really deal with life. But to assume that you could make other people more mature by just teaching them or inculcating their values, that's where I think the hoping professions go off.
The final barrier to effective leadership is overlooking the importance of the self. Instead, many leaders rely on the expertise of others rather than on their own abilities, something Dr. Friedman calls the fallacy of self.
How would you distinguish whether somebody was self-possessed or self-indulgent? We would normally use the word self-possessed in a positive way, but we normally use the word self-indulgent in a negative way. So, how would you distinguish it?
How can leaders establish their identities within the dynamics of the groups they lead? Dr. Friedman has been consulting with these community leaders for nearly 10 years. Part of their work requires them to understand and manage their own anxiety so that it doesn't inhibit their effectiveness as leaders.
Chronic anxiety is something that I believe is only reducible when you have non-anxious presences at the leadership level. And that's what ties all of this together. How does a person move in that direction? That is a big, difficult problem. That's what we spend all our time on. So that, for example, in all our training programs, whether they're for clergy, whether they're for physicians, whether they're for lawyers, administrators, and so on, part of the training program is people going back into their families of origin and trying to deal with the most anxious stuff that goes on back there. The issues they've always avoided, the issues they've always been reactive to, and to try to deal with those in a non-anxious way. To the extent people can go back into their families of origin and deal with issues that have always made them reactive, and deal with them in a non-reactive way, it immediately carries over to whatever their work system is. It immediately carries over to all other relationship systems. People who've been studying with me for years have said, I think the most common thing they say is, I am just much less anxious about life.
I must say, I didn't know what I was going to get from coming here, and it's reformulated all my thinking. And it's been very liberating, because the main way I've found to be such a non-anxious person is two things. One is, I first concentrate on where I am, and becoming comfortable with expressing that. In other words, not being anxious, not being defensive, not being argumentative, but being very centered and clear about expressing that. The second piece, which is very important, is letting go of control. I don't know what the results of that are going to be. I have to listen to the responses, and then I take the next step and formulate where I am in response to all that. So it becomes a dynamic process, leading does. It's not always knowing where you're going. It's knowing where you are. And that has done a lot to help me be non-anxious. And when I am anxious, to withdraw, I don't respond when I'm anxious. I just pull back, take a look at that, and preparing has to do with working out what that anxiety is all about.
And of course, growth produces decline.
I've been working with this group for 7 years now, and it's been a very long process in reformulating my own understanding of how I function in organizations. And I found that I work less hard, I work smarter, and rather than worrying so much about what I say, I'm very concerned with how I position myself. And so by making an act which repositions myself in any group, it has the greatest effect. And learning how to sort of chart out where I am and where the double binds are, and I pay attention to how upset I am inside, and then when I'm clear about that, I can usually move into an easier position. I try and give anxiety back to its rightful owners. I decide who belongs to a problem and where that problem belongs. I try and give it back. And then it has the most powerful effect. And so I'm practicing learning how to do that.
Mm-hmm. 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 Someone turn that off back there. There's a little button on the top.
Can you say a word more about what the last time was talking about?
I'm sorry?
Can you talk a bit about what the last person was talking about repositioning himself?
He was talking about relationships in a family, or he was talking about relationships in an organization. And if, for instance, a leader in an organization has been seen as the fix-it person, and the organization is facing a critical kind of situation. And the leader feels this is not just my responsibility, this is more people need to be involved in this. But that person has functioned over perhaps a long period of time as that sort of person. The leader has been the fix-it person. And to think through that and then reposition himself someplace else where he is not the fix-it person, and he allows other people to begin to take their rightful responsibilities. That's an example. There might be many other...
Over-functioning and under-functioning, would that
be the position? It may be over-functioning. He may not be over-functioning. He may simply be functioning in that particular way, and other people should also be functioning in that way. What reactions do you have to this in terms of society, in terms of family?
His definition of empathy, I would have a different definition. And there's been a lot of research in empathy, for example, in the hiring of school teachers and school administrators. There's a research firm that's been doing research for about 30, 40 years, and a top quality of successful teachers and school administrators has been identified, among others, as empathy. But he seems to describe a point of view that you're locked into empathy. But it seems to me it's pretty important to understand where a person is coming from, what their experiences have been, in order to move on. But he was, from what I got from him, he was describing being locked into, wallowing in with where, what has made this person, what he is, or what problems he has.
Did anybody else have a take on that?
I was seeing it differently in a decision-making process. I was saying that in a decision-making process, if you are stuck in the empathy phase, there's going to be a lot of different points of view. You're never going to get out of it.
Of course. I think anybody would recognize that.
At least that's what I was thinking. This seems
like I'm not talking about being locked into empathy. But if you just go right ahead with disregard for the people you're working with and their point of view, I think it's going to be difficult to get other, a lot of people participating.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I guess what I saw as far as that is empathy to the point of accommodating the behaviors. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges I see in the organization, in church, is somehow perceiving and understanding, better understanding what a person's background is, what their belief system is, and then being dismissive or accommodating of the behaviors that come out of that, that are disruptive to the order. And then we sort of learn how to cope with that inappropriate behavior. And instead of, I think that people can be very empathetic to what's going on, but be very clear about what's appropriate, what's not.
Yeah, Uncle Charlie is always drunk at Thanksgiving, and we just put up with it every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you knew something about Uncle Charlie's past,
you'd
buy him a bottle.
What is? Let me ask one question. What was the point he was trying to make, that empathy is not effective or appropriate in what situation? If we're trying to help someone change.
Yes.
And he, but he did not.
That's my problem.
But he did not say that it's inappropriate. He said people need to understand. I think there was a little commentary with that. And I would say that he would not say that leaders don't empathize or leaders don't need this quality. But he was saying, when you are dealing with a virus in an organization, a person who has been invasive, that people grow, that's the word, not change, he said, but people grow as they are challenged, not as one empathizes with them. Yes. But he didn't say it wasn't appropriate under certain circumstances.
To me, empathy does not mean accepting your behavior or excusing your behavior at all.
Yeah. It doesn't by any professional within the mental health field. Empathy does not mean endorsing the behavior.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So that's, the basic misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you're a leader of an organization and you mainly have empathy to someone who's disruptive, the organization is going to fall apart, and the disruptive person is going to take over, and I think that's what he meant. But in other settings, empathy is in many ways a term very similar to love, and if we have empathy and care for people and they bond with us and care for us, we're more likely to have an influence on their behavior. Now, of course, a leader of a large group who is having a disruptive person come in maybe doesn't have the time to do that. He has to look at the entire group dynamic. But there are many smaller groups where I think it would have been helpful if he had
I think and I think if I can take Dr. Friedman's position on this, I think he would say that love for people is important, but oftentimes if you want to help people grow, loving people will be challenging them.
Hard love, of course.
Yeah, tough challenging love. Them. Love. Yeah. Yeah. We're a few minutes over. I'm happy to stay and talk more, but I'm going to close it here for those of you who need to move on to something else, and we'll pick it up again tomorrow evening, talking about togetherness and separateness, and then the emotional triangle.
Are we meeting at this time?